Hi everyone, I'm Jenny Maltabano. Welcome to another edition of Problematic Women. Today, we're covering drama going down inside the Women's March, the feminist life making women miserable, Nancy Pelosi's coat, and we finally decide, is Ted Cruz's beard hot or not? I also spoke with a Hispanic conservative business owner, Ali Brito, who most definitely identifies as a problematic woman. Joining me is Kelsey Harkness of the Daily Signal and Bree Payton of the Federalist. Thanks for being here, guys.
Of course. Thanks so much for
having
us. Happy
to be here.
Always fun doing the show.
It is, and we have a lot to talk about today. Surprise, surprise, the Women's March again. Is it crumbling on itself? So there was an expose in Tablet magazine, and it revealed a shocking level of anti-Semitism baked into the Women's March and its founding. So Mercy Morganfield is quoted as saying they refused to even put anti-Semitism in the unity principles. Now, she was a former spokesperson for the Women's March. Conservatives, including both of you, Kelsey and Bree, have talked about this for a while now, noting that's a huge problem. The expose also revealed some pretty sketchy details about the Women's March's finances, including some allegations that the national organization didn't disperse any of the millions of dollars they received to local chapters doing the hard work. Where to start, Kelsey?
Where to start is the question. I guess the place I would start is by saying, we told you so. We have been voicing these concerns about anti-Semitism inside the Women's March since its founding. And, you know, I guess we, you know, a lot of, you know, us who have been covering the issue feel our concerns have been legitimized because so often, as most of our listeners, I'm sure, know by now, conservatives can raise concern about intolerance that's happening over on the left, but the mainstream media doesn't really care. They don't really listen to us. They don't really take our concerns seriously. This was, I believe, a 10,000-word expose. It was a long article in Tablet magazine, but they did a really good job getting into the weeds of what is going on here. And basically, they detail one of the very first meetings for the Women's March and how it was started with a group of white women, and then they realized, well, we need a more diverse leadership. So they brought in the founders that you know, we're all familiar with now, Tamiko Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and others. And they basically said, we're not going to come on board unless we have a leadership position. And it's really interesting to me because I remember reaching out and having conversations with the Women's March right when, you know, it first was bubbling up. It wasn't even a big thing yet. I was curious if they were going to include views of conservative women. There were a lot of course, there were a lot of Never Trumpers at the time, and there were a lot of pro-life women who wanted to be a part of it. And I wanted to know if they were going to be welcomed. And, you know, reading through this article, I saw some of these old names that I remembered reaching out to via my, you know, my press contacts. And then all of a sudden these names just went dark. I never saw them again. And once the new leadership turned over, I could never get responses from the Women's March. They wouldn't work for me. And so I guess I had a weird personal experience where maybe early on the Women's March started with good intentions, and some of those women who were originally a part of its founding, you know, from this story, we've learned they basically were kicked to the side. And maybe we would have all been better off had they been there, because it seems like they were much more open to working with a diverse coalition of women. Basically, my big takeaway from this article is that the movement got hijacked and some very sketchy things are going down with its finances, including the you know, that's a pretty big allegation that, of course, when Donald Trump became president, so many people donated to the Women's March. They brought in millions of dollars, and not a single penny of those donations actually made its way to any of the local chapters to actually help organize these marches. That is mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we should talk about the disastrous PR attempts to try to quench the fires and do some damage control that has come from Megaphone Strategies, which is the Women's March is one of their most prominent clients. Okay, so after a bunch of reporters started sharing this Tablet magazine article that came out earlier this week, a bunch of reporters, including several reporters over at The Federalist, got this super weird email from this person named Inaro Melendez of Megaphone Strategies that sent this email being like, hey, just so you know, and I'm loosely paraphrasing here, we sent a list of factual errors over to Tablet Magazine and they're in the process of issuing a correction on the story. In order to get a list of these corrections, first, you have to agree to the following terms, okay? So it said, you know, before we share the fact check, can you, and I'm quoting here, can you confirm that what I'm sending you is off the record and will not be published? And then if you're interested in publishing any part of the fact checks below, will you agree to contact us first to secure our agreement? And then will you let us know if you intend to delete your tweet pushing an article that includes sources slash allegations which were not vetted properly and in line with journalistic ethics? Once I receive your reply, I'll send over the corrections. So
I received that email.
A lot of people got it.
And Kelsey, you tweeted about it.
Yeah, it was my, I mean.
Kelsey, have you ever gotten an email like this from someone before, ever in your life?
And I think that's important to note because those of us in the industry, this email clearly raises so many red flags. But for people who don't do this for a living, they might not know how, organizations and PR firms go about contacting. But to basically, I mean, I took this email as a threat. And what I found really weird, I mean, among the many things, but the question, can you confirm what I am sending you is off the record and will not be published? So you're emailing me about a list of fact checks that you want us to incorporate into our reporting somehow, but then I have to confirm to you that what you send to me is off the record and will not be published. That was a very strange way to start the email.
Yeah.
But that was just one of the many concerns about it.
Yeah, 100%. And then the part where it's like, before you publish anything, could circle back to see if it's, you know, if we're going to give you permission to do this on or off the record. Like, okay, you need to establish that in the beginning, right? And obviously, sometimes with sources that maybe are new to, you know, just kind of everyday people that you're working with, sometimes working them a little bit to fully understand that and make sure that they're on board with you about that, okay, you know, that's a different kind of scenario. But we're dealing with a very, very public organization. It's completely absurd to give a list of things that are off the record and then say, oh, we're going to let you publish certain aspects of them, but only if you come to us asking for permission. And by the way, let us know if you're going to delete your tweets. Like, okay, my tweets are none of their business, right? As a reporter, that's none of your business. You can come to me or not come to me. You can decide if you're going to speak on the record or off the record, but don't do this weird list of demands in order to give me this secret list of supposed corrections. Like, it's completely absurd and totally backfired because a bunch of reporters ended up screen grabbing and tweeting out the email and just like mocking them, which they deserve.
Right. And I think it's actually a sign of, you know, how much the Women's March is in trouble. It's absolutely, the organization is crumbling. Oh. It's eating itself.
Yes.
I mean, this was a huge embarrassment. And Brie, I'll let you go. But I think the last thing I want to say about this whole fiasco that happened this week is that it seems like the girl, I believe her name was Morgan, who was quoted on the record in Tablet magazine. They ended the story with her hope that this whole history of anti-Semitism being baked into the founding of the Women's March would just be a blip on the movement. And that really rubbed me the wrong way because anti-Semitism is not a blip in history. It never is. Like, it needs to be a much bigger deal than just a little blip. And so the way they treat it, I think, you know, if this were any other type of racism, I don't think anyone would be using the word blip to describe it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And also, I don't know if you guys saw this, but last night, Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and I forget the other girl's name, they actually shared a minute-long video on their Facebook page last night responding to all of this backlash. And it's honestly super bizarre. They're in like a hotel hallway, and they're all standing close together and taking like a selfie kind of a style video. And they're like, you know, we don't appreciate these individuals. And they name some of the people quoted in the Tablet magazine article, basically going around talking behind our backs. We want to keep this conversation in public, so we challenge you to bring your allegations to us. And it's like, what?
That's
like,
what they did.
The burden is on you to, if you don't like what has been reported, like you need to explain and dismiss the things that are not true, right? And we were talking about this internally over at the Federalist, and Sean Davis, our co-founder, was like, all that they had to do in all of this was just, you know, disown Louis Farrakhan, say that anti-Semitism is bad. That those are literally the only two things that they needed to do, and purge people who were unwilling to do that. That was it. And they're not, they still are unable and unwilling to do that. And that speaks volumes about, you know, the legitimacy and the validity of the Tablet magazine article.
Well, from the start, it certainly hasn't been handled correctly. It goes against so many best practices. And like Kelsey said earlier, when you're doing that repeatedly, it just keeps raising red flags. So,
right,
of course, it's blowing up to a huge story yet again about the Women's March. But speaking of the Federalist, Joy Pullman wrote an article called "The Feminist Life Script Has Made Many Women Miserable. Don't Let It Sucker You." And in the article, she writes about how her unplanned pregnancy taught her to cast aside the messaging that you always hear from feminists, and it allowed her to focus on what she says is truly important in life. What did y'all make about that?
I loved this article. I've known Joy for a couple years now, and I find it so refreshing for men and women whose job is journalism. You know, they do this day in and day out, and, you know, there are, once in a while, a story becomes personal. And I think those are the stories that really, I guess, resonate with me, resonate with a lot of people. And so she used her personal experience to say, and, you know, I felt like I maybe identified with it. There's so much pressure for women who want to make it in their careers to put off having babies, raising a family, because they worry that it will hold them back. And what Joy says is this is the result of the feminist script. So she was married at the time, but she found herself in the situation of a very unplanned pregnancy. And her initial reaction was very negative, that this was going to be a burden on her life, that it's going to hold her back. And what she can now say, looking back at that a couple years later, a couple more babies later, is how grateful she is that she did have that unplanned pregnancy and didn't put off having children until later in life. Because I think a lot of us have been noticing this trend of more and more really sad articles percolating in the media about older women who have put their careers first and then realize at 40, you know, they want to start a family, that they're not complete, they're missing something in life, and it ends up being too late.
Yeah, I completely agree. So in this article, she quotes from a couple of other articles that have been circulating in the past couple of weeks, one from The Cut, in which, like, it was an advice column piece, and someone wrote in basically saying, like, I'm 35 years old and I have nothing to show for my life. I didn't, you know, settle down. I didn't start a family. I've just been moving every couple of years from town to town, and in a job that, you know, I liked at one point, but I'm kind of getting burned out and doesn't pay that well. I have a bunch of debt. Like, basically, I have nothing to show for my life. And I mean, well, of course, that's not true, right? You always have something to show for your life. That feeling or that attitude or that perspective that sometimes we can all get trapped in. I mean, it's really sad that this person is trapped in that and is experiencing it. I mean, overall, I really appreciated what Joy had to say. But it, I don't know, I guess all of these discussions that we've been having, those articles, her article a little bit, just kind of made me sad overall. Like, I think that this problem that is unique to women is a little, I mean, let's face it, we have extra challenges in our lives that men don't, right? Involving pretty much everything from start to finish of our lives. And this challenge of how do you balance a career and, you know, accomplishments in the professional world while also having a strong family and having strong family connections and having a purpose in a lot of aspects of your life, not just one, that's something that's a lot more difficult for women to have to deal with than men. And Kelsey, you and I have talked about this. I mean, I'm not married. I don't have kids. I'm 26 years old. I feel like I'm on a race right now where I have to get as far ahead as I can get in my professional career before. And I'm not putting off having kids or anything like that, but I have to do all this stuff before I have kids. So that way it's easier for me to like negotiate leave and negotiate part-time arrangements to take care of my kids. Like overall, I don't know, the demands of it are just seem overwhelming, but at the same time, I just finished, okay, this is probably a little dramatic and I'll quickly finish up my thoughts, but I just finished reading through Man's Search for Meaning. And right now I'm reading through Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. And, you know, I mean, both of those books have kind of helped give me a better perspective, which is that difficulty, hardships, struggles, and these type of things, this is what give our lives meaning, right? So this special, unique problem in air quotes that we have as women, I mean, it sucks looking at it from far away. Like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this. But I mean, rising to the occasion and completing those goals and hitting those milestones and balancing everything, that is what gives us meaning.
Well, and I think the more we can talk about it, the better it is for all women, no matter how strongly you might or might not feel about it. We need to keep having those discussions.
Yeah. Exactly. Joy ends her piece with some advice. Quote, women need and deserve their own life script, one that suits us. In order to develop one, we need to know and be told the truth about what makes women happy, what women overwhelmingly want in life, and the biological constraints of achieving our dreams. I think what she's getting to is the balance between biological reality, but also being open and honest about the fact that a lot of women in this country want children, and the feminist script telling you to put that off because you have to put your career first can end up being very hurtful in many ways, as we've been reading about more and more, it seems, in the news.
Certainly a very interesting piece, and that takes a lot of guts to publish something that personal. Okay, before I let you two go, we have a special edition of Hot or Not. Let's start with Ted Cruz's beard. Kelsey.
I'm going to say hot.
Oh, I said hot too.
Oh my gosh. I can't even believe I'm outnumbered on this. This is like objectively gross. Objectively so
our
bad.
Our producers are hot too. Giving, 3-1.
Yeah. Okay. So Lauren is giving. Wait, you think it's hot? Oh my gosh. Lauren thinks it's hot too. I can't even believe this. No, it's the worst thing I've ever seen.
It makes him more relatable.
No, it doesn't. It just, oh. I'm like trying not to squirm in my chair, but I can't help it. I think it's the worst thing I've ever seen.
Wow.
Full stop.
Very strong opinion. Okay. All right. Next up, maybe we'll have some more unity on this. Nancy Pelosi's jacket that inspired all of those memes when she walked out of the West Wing with Chuck Schumer. Max Mara is they're bringing the coat back. So they stopped making it in 2013. But because of all this popularity, it's coming on back. Hot or not?
Hot. It's burnt orange. Do you think that has anything to do with President Trump? Was that? I would say only Melania would be that good at trolling to actually like plan that far in advance.
Yeah, I don't know that it was, but this is definitely one of her colors. It goes well with her skin tone. It goes well with her hair. I think the cut of the coat is awesome. I like it.
I like it, but it was.
It's not groundbreaking.
And it was going viral as if it was groundbreaking. Yeah, but the reality is, yeah, it's a nice, pretty basic winter coat. I actually have one just like it, except it's a little more of a bright orange. I get compliments all the time. And I think the big takeaway from this is that colored winter coats are awesome. And you'll always get compliments when you wear them. So go out and find yourself a colored winter coat for Christmas.
We can all agree on that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good note to end it on. Kelsey, Bree, thank you so much. Next up, my one-on-one interview with Ali Brito.
Americans have almost entirely forgotten their history.
That's right, and if we want to keep our republic, this needs to change.
I'm Jarrett Stepman.
And I'm Fred Lucas.
We host The Right Side of History, a podcast dedicated to restoring informed patriotism and busting the negative narratives about America's past. Hollywood, the media, and academia have failed a generation.
We're here to set the record straight on the ideas and people who've made this country great.
Subscribe to The Right Side of History on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Stitcher today.
Well, on today's Problematic Women, I'm joined by Allie Brito. Allie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. We're excited to have you.
Now, you are Latina. You are conservative. You're a businesswoman. Do you think you would identify as a problematic woman?
I absolutely would.
Well, I want to start with what led you to starting your own business and what that experience was like.
I think that freedom has always been part of my vocabulary. I think that, you know, along with that, there's always been some sort of stigma that to have freedom and to have your own business and, you know, all of these things in one, you can't have your family and your foundation and your base. And I just, you know, didn't like that answer. I didn't like that theory. I didn't like that concept. So I think that that's, you know, really like the passion of being who I am and the creative person that I am, and also, you know, allowing, you know, my family and everything to be a part of that. So I you know, and to show my family that it's all possible.
Absolutely. How did you first get interested in politics? When we were talking before, you mentioned, I believe your grandfather was in politics in Cuba.
Yeah. So my grandfather was, I mean, as a little girl, the number one thing I remember was just him, you know, listening to the Cuban radio and you know, he came to the United States, you know, fled a communist country, came here, worked hard as a bartender, then went on to own his own business. I mean, the real American dream. And, you know, he always put a major emphasis on how family was the most important, but then our country was something that had to go hand in hand with that. How are we going to protect our family from, you know, everything that's going on, you know, and not care about our country, you know? The country was extremely important to him, and he put that major emphasis.
So how does it make you feel when you see studies today that show that youth in America, they love socialism? They think it's the greatest thing ever.
I don't think they understand it. I don't think that they can't possibly understand it. Take them to a socialist country. Take them to a communist country, because that's, you know, the direction it leads to. Take them to that and show them how it starts. Yeah, it's a beautiful picture. We all share, we pitch in. It's you know, it's painted with amazing propaganda, but to actually live in that, you get every freedom stripped away from you, and you don't realize it.
I know. I agree with you. They all need to go over to communist countries like Venezuela for a week or so and really take it in. You know, which political issues are most important to you?
Which political issues are most important to me? Well, I have two children. So, you know, for me, the safety, you know, their safety is extremely important to me. So, you know, the safety of this country and, you know, education and where that's going, you know, and the mentality that I think, you know, the role models that are in front of them were not, the conservative side, I don't think, has a lot of representation where they should. And it just worries me, because I really think that they need to understand what a base and a foundation is. And with the liberal mentality or views, it's almost like you don't need that. It's a free for all. And it's not, you know, without a base and foundation, you can't, it just breaks. And I worry that my kids are not going to have that. So, you know, to circle back to the answer to the question, you know, I want them to be safe. I want them to feel that we're a strong country, and that, you know, hard work is what pushes us forward,
right?
Not sets us back.
Well, as conservative women, we're in a bit of a unique group, I would say, a unique club. I know you've written a little bit about feminism and some of the hypocrisy there. Can you talk about that?
I think I wrote an op-ed, correct, about, you know, the First Lady especially.
Yes.
I think that the way the media treats her is completely disrespectful. It's unfair completely. So I just, you know, we need to have more, we have to have more of a presence. And, you know, on the side of being Latin, being a woman, I'm not sure why liberals have taken that and the diversity card and have kind of run with it, where there's a whole other side that, you know, is conservative, is Latina, is very much about women empowerment. And it's almost like the liberals have just completely hijacked that. And it's just not the case.
Well, and it's so disappointing to see how the media treats her, for example, when she's doing great work. I know you just got back from the White House and you saw her famous red trees.
It was absolutely beautiful. Everything. I mean, you know, the touches, the details. Yes, absolutely.
Well, and you mentioned having good role models. Are there any women in the conservative movement who you admire?
Well, I think that, you know, currently, I can tell you as a little girl growing up, I did not relate to who my role models would have been or what society would want them to be, which were Barbara Bush or, Hillary Clinton. Not because of anything bad, but, you know, the age gap, they weren't relatable to me. As far as Melania, if she was my first lady growing up, or I would have related much more to her. I would have, you know, looked at her more as a mentor.
It seems like she's in a position to really do a lot of good if people will just give her the chance.
Exactly.
Well, that's very interesting. I want to also ask you about your views on President Trump. How do you think he's doing so far in his first term? The media always, you know, portrays one thing, but it seems like something else is going on. What's your take?
Well, as a business owner, I mean, my whole thing is taxes. I don't know. I'm dealing with that now. And I just, you know, I feel like, you know, our country is confident because our economy is doing well, but they're not giving the president credit. Like, why is this, you know, why are we doing well? Why do things seem to be moving along? Well, I mean, our leader is leading the way. So I voted for Trump and I'll vote for him again. And I, you know, there's nothing else I can say. And I don't think I should, you know, be judged for it, or, you know, it's just how I feel.
Right. I want to ask you one more question, and I want to circle back to the beginning. Why do you think it's so problematic to be a conservative woman?
Why? I think that we're misunderstood. And what I told you earlier, how I believe the liberals have completely hijacked what it means to be diverse, conservative, feminist, all of these things. I believe that we're just completely misunderstood and we're not given the voice because it's just been taken away from us.
Well, that's why we need people like you to keep speaking out and getting involved in politics. So I want to thank you so much for coming on Problematic Women this week. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to leave it there for today. Thanks so much for listening to the Daily Signal podcast, brought to you from the Robert H. Bruce Radio Studio at the Heritage Foundation.
Please be sure to subscribe on iTunes, which, yes, Apple owns, Google Play, or SoundCloud. And please leave us a review or a rating on iTunes to give us any feedback.
Rob and Jenny will be with you on Monday.